Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für die Dame, die den Namen Susan Sontag liest und gleich an Tiffany-Lampen denken muss. Heute zu Gast Performer, Opernsänger, Songwriter, alles mit Sternchen und Drag Queen Shlomi Moto Wagner. Shlomi wurde in Israel geboren, studierte an der Tel Aviv Music Academy und an der Manhattan School of Music in New York. Seit 2012 lebt Shlomi in Berlin, wo er im experimentellen Musiktheaterbereich unterwegs ist. Im November zeigt Shlomi seine neueste Arbeit, Richard Wagner, The Drag Queen, im Berliner Ballhaus Ost. Ich will mit Shlomi darüber sprechen, wie überschneidet sich Oper und Drag? Wie nimmt Shlomi die Trennung von ernster und unterhaltender Kunst hier in Deutschland wahr? Und wie lebt es sich 2 Jahre nach dem 7. Oktober 2023 als jüdischer Künstler, jüdische Künstlerin in Berlin? Ich wünsche uns allen erhellende Momente. Viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit Shlomi Moto Wagner. So you are working in drag and you have a background in opera. And I was wondering, like, how do you think those two things connect, or do they connect for you, like in your work or in your practice?
Opera and drag, I mean, nowadays, of course, for me, they really go hand in hand on so many different levels. That wasn't always the case. I actually grew up fascinated by opera since my teen years, but totally frightened and afraid of drag queens. I could never imagine becoming a drag queen while everything I wanted was to become an opera singer.
And so you were not afraid by opera?
No, opera was for me really symbolizing this, the climax of beauty in music, in voices, in telling a story, in creating an emotional moment, in drama, in ways that I didn't know even exist. I only got exposed to opera in my teen years when I was 16, and I met a friend of my parents who is an opera singer and exposed me to that. I used to sing all my life, but I was just singing pop music, folk music in the city I grew up in. And I mean, from a very young age, I was just spotted as the singer, and I always was given singing opportunities. And it was clear to me that that's how I communicate with the world, and that's what I want to continue to do. I had no idea what it means to live and work as an artist. My family are a family of scientists, doctors, you know, immigrant Jewish family. Just go for the prototype. And yeah, so I found my way to studying opera, getting so fascinated and decided to go and starting to study opera. Now, fast forward 20 years later, I'm in Berlin. I'm a drag queen. I'm an opera singer, performer that combines those things together. And actually, I don't know if our listeners know, but you are actually the reason that I found a way to connect them together, right? When I moved to Berlin, I thought I am going to be Shlomi Wagner, the baritone opera singer. And that really was the only trajectory I could imagine for my career. I started really dabbing into drag through RuPaul's Drag Race, right? First time I saw RuPaul's Drag Race when a friend of mine from New York came to visit me, and we were watching together the series, and suddenly I was like, what? These are the drag queens, those people? It's like, I saw myself. And that totally changed my life. Mm-hmm. And yeah, in so many different ways, which I'll get into. I think it's also important as a performer and opera in general. But it's really through you, because when at that time when you were casting for a show for Reading Salome, my friends from the opera direction, my friends from the drag direction sent me this open call that there is this director duo and they're looking for someone who is interested in opera and drag. And I wasn't really sure how that's going to work out, obviously, but since then, we had, you know, a couple of years of working together and deepening into this connection, which was so fascinating for me. And I was like, that's exactly actually what I want to do, right? This is, you really managed to find this language where those two art forms find a common grounds and actually don't just oppose each other, but really complement. So how does that translate to me is that, first of all, there's two art forms are fetishizing the voice.
Yeah.
We know how it is in the opera and also in drag, right? So if in opera, it's like possessing this beauty in the voice that fills a room, the voice that becomes an object of desire that touches your body, that all the rich overtones and the excess of the voice in the expression. In drag, it's the lack of the voice and the reclaiming of the voice and embodying the voice. So like
through lip syncing or through like playback.
Exactly. Yes. Through lip syncing and playback, which for a long time, I didn't understand really lip syncing and what is the thing that really fascinates about it. But the more I was working in the connection between of the two, you really start feeling this embodied experience of making music through lip syncing. Because when we listen to music in general, just as listeners, there is always this moment of cognitive embodiment where you think that you actually start to control the music yourself, just as a listener, right? You know what the singer is going to do and and you're almost the one who directs the song at the moment you just listen to it. And when you do it as a lip sync, it really changes you also from within and it empowers you. So this is really another art form where there is this moment of transformation, empowerment through the voice. And for me, this is really like they complement each other in opera and in drag.
Yeah, I found it also so fascinating that if you look at photos from opera singers, because they are usually, especially like older, like in the tradition when they played opera, like traditionally, they all look like drag queens, the men and the women. Like the makeup is so heavy because it's like for this huge auditorium of audiences.
Yeah.
And they have this thick like eyelashes and too much going on in their faces, so it translates to the like
to the last row to the last queen in the club. It's the same thing. You want everyone in the club to see you, so you wear the highest heels, the biggest wig, and yeah, it's really about celebrating this. You know, in drag it's tiny bit different because you exaggerate to celebrate those things that you used to be ashamed of, which in my case was like expressing any femininity, which also connects to my career as an opera singer, because as an opera singer with a baritone voice, I was only given male roles, the most traditional baritone roles. And I always had this fear or anxiety of presenting feminine, presenting gay, presenting in a way that is not socially acceptable of what does it mean to be now the baritone lover, male, that you want to present on stage.
The hero,
Totally, the savior, the hero, which later I found out actually the drag queen is the savior. The drag queen is the hero, because only then when I started doing drag, I felt this freedom on stage. I don't have to think about it anymore. I can really go on stage and present anything that I desire in such freedom, and it empowered me that now when I'm not in drag, I just tap back into that freedom. It changed my entire singing. It changed my entire presentation on stage. Also understanding that like there are so many different ways to present male and so on. But I only got it after I let myself go on stage and be like, I'm not going to hide anymore those things or try to censor myself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really the heels, the wigs, and a lot of glitter that made me a better opera singer.
Okay. So how did you get in contact with opera and with drag?
So opera was through a friend of my parents that I met when I was 16. And he gave me a CD of, you know, the highlights of opera. Suddenly I heard the Queen of the Night. I heard this beautiful Cherubino duet. Who is it? Cherubino and
Susanna.
Cherubino and Susanna. Yeah. Is it? Anyways, from The Marriage of Figaro, this Aprite presto, aprite. Aprite la Susanna. Aprite, soprite. So beautiful. I was like, wow, how do you play with the voices like this? How do you tell this? You know, it's so light and cheerful. And the aria Castadiva of Norma, you hear like, oh my God, the entire mythological world opens up in front of your ears, right?
Yeah.
Just by listening to this beautiful piece of music. And I started taking voice lessons. Yeah. And slowly, like starting the progress of discovering my voice. And I got into the Music Academy in Israel, in Tel Aviv, where I studied with Agnes Messini. She was a legendary voice teacher from Hungary Jewish Hungarian who moved to Israel. And she used to speak with this Hungarian accent, Shlomi, oh! It was so great. It was really like to hear the stories of the old operatic life from this person. And then I met... Thinking of drag queens. I mean, definitely one of my...
She sounds like a drag queen.
She was, unknowingly or knowingly, was one of my inspirations, you know?
Yeah,
and then I met Trish McCaffrey, also another legendary teacher from New York, and I moved to New York. I studied there a couple of years. I took a little break, then I moved back to Israel. I studied mathematics, interdisciplinary arts, philosophy, and then I got into the Opera House, the Young Artist Program, and I just started singing full-time. That was really when I got a lot of practice and training and just singing all the baritone roles, the young baritone roles, the lyrical roles, Papageno, Conte, Figaro, Dandini, the father in Hansel and Gretel, whatever. And
But did you grow up in a household where like classical music was all around you? Or did you grow up in a household where it's like very artistic or they... went to the theater with you, or was it just like pop culture, or what kind of stuff did you grew up with?
Yeah, so I grew up in, it's kind of like a Russian immigrant family. My parents moved from Moscow and St. Petersburg in the 70s, but they were like Russian intellectuals, doctors, scientists, and so on. So they were listening to, they loved poetry. I had so many tapes of poetry readings in my house. My father used to love to write poetry. He was a poet also, while also being a physics professor. And they loved the classics. They loved Tchaikovsky and Pushkin and all that. But we weren't really going into the theater. It wasn't really part of my culture. I actually didn't really understand theater. Even after I started singing opera, I didn't understand why people go on stage and speak. How come people go on stage and they don't sing? I couldn't get it. It really took me years, only in New York, when I started seeing more experimental contemporary performance in La Mama and other venues. Yeah. I was like, okay. You can tell stories like that as well. There's so many different ways. It was really eye-opening. Yeah. But actually, the thing that did like change me and inspired me to choose Berlin also as the place to come and do theater and music was that quite early in my 20s, I discovered Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill. The Threepenny Opera, the Seven Deadly Sin, and more. And that was fascinating. I was like, you can also make opera like this or a musical theater like that? Like, you know, the subjects are totally different than the classical subjects we know that you usually perform in operas. The voices are so diverse. The dramaturgy is totally different. Yeah, combining kind of like social realism together with also like big social values and mythical stories that are told in very like social realistic ways, but also with like the beautiful way that Kurt Weill can create this like classical sounds, but with like jazzy influences. Things that, like, actually that he created. He had a very discovery style that and language that he had.
Yeah, that's funny because Threepenny Opera is really, like, somehow in the middle between, like, being entertainment or being, like, considered art. So it has a little musical, a little bit, like, operetta in it. But it's taken very seriously in Germany because it's this famous, like, iconic...
Yeah.
So I found it interesting that you were drawn to this kind of theater, or it totally makes sense that you liked that.
Definitely, because also, you know, where I grew up, we didn't have this kind of things. I mean, the opera in Israel was just always presenting only classical stuff. You rarely see something else than Mozart or Verdi, right? Yeah, so that was really eye-opening for me. But then you also asked about drag.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it was really after RuPaul's Drag Race that I started doing drag, and I just moved to Berlin. I started like 2-3 months before I moved to Berlin. I was still working at the Opera House in Israel, and I had access to the costume store of the Opera House. And my friend who came from New York to visit me and introduced me to that, it opened my eyes, and we just went to the costume store and we played with all the costumes we could find. And since then I was like, this is so much fun. I had makeup because in the Opera House, they also taught me how to, you know, to put on makeup for all the different shows and roles. So since then it was just, honey, the carnival is open. And you can just choose whatever you want. So once I moved to Berlin, that was really one of my goals. Also, like, to go and find any stage that I can. And I had fire in me. It's like unbelievable how it's very hard to explain this fire and motivation that you have, like, especially to do such an art form like drag, where you know that it's socially taboo. You know, like, I was afraid also that my colleagues from the opera would kind of like judge me for doing drag and that I will get less roles, I wouldn't be taken seriously and so on. So I was still questioning a lot of those things, and my internalized homophobia was still kind of like, you know, something that was on my mind. But slowly and surely, like with that fire I had, I found more and more stages. Back then in Berlin, there was this Israeli party called Meshuga.
Mm-hmm.
It ran in Berlin for like 15 years, I think. And I just became like the queen of the house for a couple of years. I was performing there like party after party. And suddenly I have a chance to get a stage to choose for myself what I want to perform, how I want to present myself, what's the repertoire, what I'm doing, you know, to stage myself, to choreograph myself, to lip sync, to sing. And I started like slowly crafting all those skills because I never done it myself, right? As a singer, you get the notes, you learn the score, you come to rehearsals, you're told what to do, and you go on stage and you just do that, right? I never choose what is being put on stage. And suddenly, it's, you know, it's all kind of like my freedom to do so.
Yeah.
With the help of the community and people around me, I slowly kind of like developed more and more.
Berlin is also like a city which somehow embraces or invites this kind of like blurring the boundaries maybe between drag, opera, serious, entertaining. I don't know. I think Berlin is maybe a good playground for something like this. Did it feel for you like that? That you, yeah.
Yeah, I knew I was going to find it here, as said, because of Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht. So for me, it was already tradition from like 100 years ago, right? And I'm sure that maybe it was even before. And also, when I just moved to Berlin, Berlin was relatively still cheap and still affordable. There were spaces for artists. You could, you know, find a place to live, find a place to rehearse. You wouldn't have to spend your entire day's time on just, you know, making ends meet. And you can just try out things. And when a city provides, you know, the time and the space for so many people to come together, that's when the magic happens, right? You can develop new language. You can develop new ways to express and for artistic research and so on. So for me, it was really a playground. But as I said, it wasn't really until I started working with you and Felina Rinat that those things really came together in more like in a full way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not.
I can still remember how you came to the audition. Like, I think you had like, your arms painted black.
Yes.
Like your hands and your arms, like, and the rest, were you half naked? I don't know. There was a lot of skin and a lot of like black paint on your, like
my
you.
Hand, yeah, my hand was the head of Yohanan. So it was burnt. I was singing to my hand because we were lip syncing the final aria of Salome.
Yeah.
That was the thing.
It's so interesting how everybody interpreted the like the head. For example, like Bianca, who was in the show, also in this Salome show, she came with a like styrofoam head. She had an assistant coming in, placing the, we were like, what's happening now? The styrofoam head on the
on the floor, and then she entered in like a glorious costume. And your version was like, yeah, with the hands. I still have this picture of like the black, wow, the ashy, I don't know, hands or something.
Yeah, I covered my entire hand black. I remember that day. And actually, to that audition, I took the U-Bahn. Right? Oh. I would never do that today. But back then, I was so young, motivated, and fearless. And I just took the U-Bahn. I took the public train from Wittenbergplatz to Märkisches Museum, to Theaterhaus Mitte in Berlin. And the looks I got. Can you imagine to see a queen with like black, ashy hands? And like, I had this crazy makeup. Oh, my God.
But no wig, I think. If I remember correctly, you had no wig.
I don't remember.
Or was it Mazzy's wig? Like the famous Mazzy?
The famous...
Because that's your name, like at the house of... What was the house called? The house of Mazel Tov. You were, yeah, Mazzy Mazel Tov.
Yeah, still Mazzy Mazel Tov. I mean, she comes back. You know, I mean, you know me now for a couple of years. You know, I had my moments of like, Mazzy's dead. Mazzy's gone. I'm done with her. I can't take care of her.
You have a toxic relationship. Like she's a narcissist, maybe. She's like,
oh God, this is a narcissist in life.
Shlomi, she's breadcrumbing you. She's
oh my God, I've been gaslitten by Mazzy. Yeah. No, but I think it's part of really the developing and progress, because I also had to, after I kind of like, quote unquote, gave away Mazzy, killed Mazzy, I started doing drag as Shlomi, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I needed to go through that step as well, where, yeah, I can also present as Shlomi with makeup and so on, as also a way of presentation of performance. And, you know, I'm going to perform as Mazzy in Shvutz at the end of the month again. So I love to go back to Mazzy and, you know, have a show in the club with the community here in Berlin that gave me so much power and empowerment, and that's not gonna like go away.
So she's breadcrumbing us. She's not breadcrumbing you. She's breadcrumbing us. Like every now and then, she gives us a little bit, just a little, to leave us wanting more. You know, like when does she appear next? Mazzy, she's gone now, but. Yeah, but I think, I wanted to ask you that, because I think I never, through all the years working together or knowing you, I think I never asked you, like, how did you, you are from Israel, so you seem to be Jewish.
How, I know what you're talking about.
yeah. So what made you decide to come to Berlin, of all places, apart from being a place where you think you could thrive artistically? There could be like a lot of reason for a Jewish person not to come to Berlin.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, as growing up, I remember my father telling us that he was offered job opportunities in Germany that he declined. And it was part of growing up in Israel, obviously, that the entire Holocaust history, the Second World War, the collective trauma that has really been taught, and it's very present growing up in Israel. But art was something I believed in, and really it was the art that brought me here. And just, yeah, I don't know, it was somehow that I never saw Berlin as this place where the Holocaust took place in. Like, even moving here, it's only after some time that I started, you know, exploring the topography of the city, the memorial sites, and so on. But Berlin is much more than that, right? So that's one thing. The other thing is, actually, what an amazing thing it is that I'm a Jewish person living today in Berlin, working with Germans, living with Germans, you know, like being part of the culture, telling stories to people, right? Sharing this emotional, expressive energy with people. Like when 100 years ago, like all the craziness started. I mean, okay, anti-Semitism was even before the Holocaust. But for me, it's like, you know, like this is where I have to believe that things will get better, that, you know, we can live together, that there is more than what we had, right? There are new ways to live together. So yeah, history is one part, but I think in the present moment, there is so much more we can do. And I always think about it also, you know, just as an Israeli today, with today's Israeli politics, the war in Israel, the genocide in Gaza, all this, you know, like 100 years of occupation and so on. Can I believe that one day we'll be able to coexist? Yes, I can. And I'm a proof that it's possible because I'm in Berlin today, a Jew living with Germans. But actually, it's really giving me hope that one day also Palestinians and Israelis could like find a way to live together.
You mentioned the ongoing like war. Can you feel like the... Oh, I wanted to ask you like how the situation is for you as a Jewish artist at the moment being in Berlin. Because I imagine it to be before October 7th, it was maybe sometimes maybe also a strange situation to be in Germany. But after October 7th, especially like in the cultural sector, like they were kind of really slow in reacting to the massacre of October 7th. So I wanted to ask you how it feels at the moment to be like Jewish and work in the arts.
Yeah, so many, many things changed, obviously. I think that really after the October 7th, I realized that I started feeling by myself something that many Jews were telling me, especially Jews that grew up in Germany, they were saying, yes, we are many times just projection surfaces for, you know, for Germans who are not Jewish and that have to deal with their past and so on. And after October 7, kind of like this awareness became much, much, much more present in my life. Yeah, it's really, really hard. It's really hard, like, to, I just become speechless. But I just, it's hard. It's hard to hear of, like, friends being canceled, of anti-Semitism rising. I mean, anti-Semitism was always there, right? It's just for thousands of years a phenomena that we're dealing with, and suddenly it's just much more present. It happens on almost like daily, weekly basis that I hear of friends that don't feel safe being attacked over an attack in a synagogue. People just not feeling safe to share their identity, that they're Jewish or Israeli, right? I don't feel safe in Berlin to walk with a kippah or any like visible Jewish symbols. Nonetheless, of course, not Israeli. That will be even worse. But yeah, that's part of my identity, right? I cannot like run away from it or hide from it. It is, that's who I am. My name gives it up already. My name is Shlomi. I don't think there is any more Jewish name than that.
Yeah.
Which used to be also like a slur word during the Nazi time and probably even before. Jew.
Like to make fun of like Jews to use the word Shlomi. Like, yeah.
Shlomo, or he's a Moshe. You know, even when people, to make fun of the Yiddish language, they would call it Mushel, like from Moshe.
Mm-hmm.
Moshen. They're Moshel. There are so many different ways that, like, that's actually one of the things that Wagner, you know, was writing about. Wagner, the main thesis in his essay about a very anti-Semitic essay is about Jews cannot make music because they cannot master the language.
Yeah.
Listen to their Deutsch.
Yeah.
Right? So that's his main thesis. So, yeah, you know, it comes, it's just like, the past that kind of like comes back now, and suddenly you live this like reality where you don't feel safe in a city, right? And
yeah, but because I was wondering, like, it's like we are now somehow like also maybe attacked from two sides. It's like not for only being Jewish, but also because you are very vocal about being anti the whole war and the whole genocide thing, of course. And this also sometimes results in then suddenly people say, this is itself, it's anti-Semitic or something.
Oh my, totally. Yes. I used to be that person as well. You know, that's the thing. You would always be able to tell someone you're being anti-Semitic for anything the person does. So this is really like insane what's happening nowadays. Like every Jew can be accused of an anti-Semitism nowadays. And this is kind of like this cycle of horror that we relive and it just doesn't end. And today I am really, as you say, it's true. Like my Israeli friends who are still kind of like live this propaganda idea of like we are only the victims and so on. They're really upset with me for the things I share and the thing I say, you know, that we cannot accept it. And on the other hand, the anti-Semites here at my second home in Germany attacking me from the other way. And I know for many Israelis who are like actually critical of Israel, they say, I will never do it publicly because I don't want to give power to the anti-Semites here. You know, I don't want to like give them another reason to hate us more. So it's so complex. It's really complex. So I really try to just be true to the values I believe in and believing that no matter what happens, we have to hope that there is still a way to find a mutual language and coexistence, to find restoration, to acknowledge our wrongs, to acknowledge, you know, the genocide, to acknowledge the years of occupation and so on. But we have to admit that there is hope. We have to hope that, you know, this can happen.
Yeah, that's right. You already talked about, you mentioned the name Wagner, which is, funny enough, your last name of all names. I mean, like Shlomi Wagner, could there be a more like yin and yang?
I know, it's a
yin and yang kind of name.
Shlomi Wagner, who is a Jewish drag queen in Berlin.
No, yeah.
Right?
But quick question before, like, how does the Wagner name, how's that your name?
You know, it's a really good question. So obviously I'm an Ashkenazi Jew. My family spent many years in Europe. So as I said, my parents lived and grew up in Russia, but their parents came from Austro-Hungary. From the election, we had family in Wien. We had family in Germany at a certain point. In Romania, you know, there is like, I know at least 7-8 generations of migration in my family. So that's really the classical, typical European Jewish story before the Second World War.
Yeah.
Generations of migration, finding actually, my mother's side was settled in a village in Ukraine for many generations where they were also very Jewish. And my grandfather from my mother's side was a cantor, very religious. From my father's side, more intellectuals in Vienna and so on. And that's where the name Wagner came from. Mm-hmm. Where I also found out that my grand-grand-grandfather in Vienna used to be an actor and a singer in the Yiddish Spiel.
Mm-hmm.
Where, by the way, the men used to play the female roles. So he was doing drag.
Oh.
Yes, honey, my grand-grand-grandfather, we are already like my ancestors.
It's just a family tradition you are continuing here.
Tradition. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I found it really interesting. But as you say, for most of my growing up, it was a contradiction. I remember when I, in Israel, growing up in kind of like trying to always find musical teachers and mentors, people would hear I'm Wagner. They're like, oh, wow. Well, what a name and so on. And I really felt like, yeah, I don't understand. You know, how did I get this like super Jewish and super
German,
important German, name? And when I was in New York, I met Slavoj Žižek. I was working in a cafe and he came to have a coffee and I was serving him coffee and we started having this conversation and I presented myself, you know, it was very friendly. And then he was telling me about the entire tradition of people that like Jews in Europe were the most German names, like Siegfried, Jerusalem and stuff like this. And then after I moved to Berlin, I went with a group to the Auschwitz Memorial Center, to the museum. And there they have this book with all the names of the people that were killed at the concentration camp, at the death camp. It was a KZ. And I was like, yeah, let's see. Was there a Shlomi here? And I go and I find Shloime Wagner. And actually, this moment really did something with me because then I realized, wait, I was always here. You know, like, it's not like I was invented in Israel with the name Shlomi, where they wanted kind of like, you know, the entire ethos of creating a Jewish state learning Hebrew, giving everyone Hebrew names and so on, reviving the culture and the language. But it used to be in Europe as well before, right?
Yeah.
It was so rich. And then I realized, wow, I'm part of this culture. Maybe there was a break in the middle, right? There was a break in the middle.
Yes.
I am here living the life that my ancestor were living, it kind of like really gave me this feeling of belonging, actually.
That place
of horror and death and so on, I was like, wow, actually, we are part of this all, right?
Does the story also connect to the project you are doing now, like the Richard Wagner project?
Yes, good that you're asking, because after I actually found out about Shloime Mandel Wagner, he was my great-great-grandfather in Vienna, who was in the Yiddish Spiel, I found in the journals of my grandmother that she wrote that he had a special connection to Richard Wagner and that they were actually faraway cousins. Believe it or not, the Richard Wagner and my grand-grand-grandfather, Shloime Mandel Wagner. And not only that, that was exactly the time that Richard Wagner came to Vienna to work on Tristan und Isolde. And when he found this Putzmacherin, Goldwag, also a Jewish Putzmacherin.
Yeah.
Yes. And she started creating for him all those feminine dresses that he used to love. You know, he had this fetish to pink satin, to pink silk, and so on.
Who? Richard. Your grandfather or Richard? Which Richard?
Honey, don't you know? This is all documented, with letters that he wrote to the Putzmacherin. He spent about 1 million euros on pink satin with ribbons, the things that, men that time would never wear. And he would order her to come to his place to bring all the women negligee and show it to him. No, there is a big thing. And actually, this all came to the public in 1877 in Wien. All those letters were published, of his orders, of the bills. You can find even just one bill for over 250,000 euros. It was really an obsession. Magnus Hirschfeld in the 20s wrote about it. I mean, an entire chapter in his book, The Travestiten. About Richard Wagner, he was asking, is it fetishism or is it cross-dressing? And it was somewhere in between. Richard Wagner was a cross-dresser, and my grand-grand-grandfather, Shloime Mandel Wagner, was the drag mother, believe it or not. So this is where my show starts, with this revelation. And that was the time of Tristan und Isolde, and he was in big debt. The production failed. It never went on stage. It was unsingable. The tenor lost his voice. He had to flee Vienna with debt, penniless, and in order to flee from his debtors and the police, he was wearing dresses. He was disguised as a woman, so they wouldn't catch him. And the police report would say, looking for wanted Richard Wagner wearing female clothes in pink silk. Yes, honey.
Yeah.
And thanks to Cosima, no one knows that because his wife was so good at trying to delete and, change.
Delete everything.
Yes, change in the entire history and the entire family, they didn't want anyone to talk about it. And I kind of like suddenly stumbled on top of that in my grandmother's journal. So I started this entire investigation and research. So the show is called Richard Wagner, the Drag Queen. And it tells the entire censored and deleted story of Richard Wagner, the relationship with Shloime. Actually, there is an entire Tristan und Isolde version in Yiddish because he created some parts for the salon that my grand-grandfather used to perform at in Yiddish. Super interesting. So you're going to hear a bit of Tristan und Isolde in Yiddish at the show as well.
Which part are you singing? Like both? Are you Tristan or are you Isolde or both? Or
Isolde, of course.
Of course.
Isolde, actually, in Yiddish.
Okay.
Yeah. And yeah, it's just going to be a really, really interesting evening. I'm writing the script, as we speak. I'm composing the music. I'm producing a lot of beautiful, draggy, lip-syncy things with Zitats of Wagner's soprano heroines with contemporary voices, electronic beats. It's going to be everything there together with the research I did with my family, with a really, yeah, amazing team I trust. It's going to be a lot of video, beautiful costumes. It's going to happen at Ballhaus Ost at the end of November. So Ballhaus Ost in Berlin, November 28, 29, and 30. And after the premiere, probably it's going to tour around Germany and next season in Bayreuth. Katharina, did you hear me? We are family, honey. Don't run away.
We're calling the ghost of Katharina. Make it happen. I wanted to ask you also, like, that sounds like a very entertaining, like a very fun, yeah, fun show. Like, do you have some kind of theories about, like, sometimes my theory is a little bit like that the whole like entertainment and art scene in Germany is very like separated, or like everything that's too entertaining is not art and art is not allowed to be entertaining at all. It has to be like cryptic and blah, 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 unless it's otherwise it's not art. Do you have some kind of theory where this comes from now being here for some kind of years?
Look, I think it comes from, we live in a society in Germany that is very hierarchical, and it goes a lot about power. There is a lot of power game here. Okay, in every society, let's put it like this. But here it's really structurized, and art has been really cultivated by the academia. So the academia is really the force that controls the art world, right? And you really see that in classical music, which in other cultures, for example, in India, classical music that is thousands of years old, more than what we have here in the West, so rich and beautiful. It's not the universities and academias where it's been practiced and learned. You know, it's in the temples, it's in the villages, it's in the, and that's the classic.
So it's an everyday life, so to speak.
Yes, yes, yes. And it's in the liturgy, in the everyday life, in the folk music, and also in Bollywood music. Suddenly, you know, it's all kind of like influences each other. In Germany, it's still the academia and the institutions that control the production of art. Yet, at the same time, it's amazing, you know. We need actually to have those institutions that support, that give money, that give space and time to create art, right? But we are losing here something really important, because our art becomes inaccessible and it becomes, yeah, elitist in a way, that we are losing an entire audience. And we see it today in our politics, because when you look at who is actually voting for the far right in Germany today, it's the young people. And the people that don't go in Berlin to Sophienzelle, to Hau or Ballhaus Ost, or, you know, all the independent theaters or the places that make art, that, you know, to Volksbühne or Schaubühne, they're not there. They are on TikTok, they are on other places, they're streaming. And if they go to the street and outside, they're in the clubs and so on. So we have to also put actually investments and fundings in art that is going to be created also in alternative spaces that are not where we think actually that. I mean, it's important to have those theaters we have, because that's already a place where we can experiment. But we must also look at the entertainment industry and the pop music, pop culture.
Yeah, that's right. Because there's a lot of people who are just not addressed by a piece at Volksbühne, who are not even invited. Like also like how the flyers are designed and everything. It's like no, it's not for me. You know, it has this like, I see your point.
Why would they go? And I think here drag is so important, because drag is pop culture. Drag is
show,
but it's also dealing with the taboo. With all those values that we are not like, that are in a way also mythological, like in opera, you know? Like, these are the deepest gender sexual questions that we have as a society. What is allowed and not allowed? What do we believe in? What is femininity? What is divinity, right? So I think in that sense, to have drag, for example, in all those pop spaces, I would say, entertainment spaces is so important, and it's so amazing that it gets much more recognition. But yeah, but I think this division is not helping anyone, basically. And it's really only the result of this power of institution or holding the power of transmitting the education of art, you know, like the mediation and education of the artists and creating the spaces for, yeah, artists to find their language and so on. And it shouldn't be only there. And for example, I really like what the Musikbund in Berlin is doing. There is an entire funding stream of the Berliner Senat in music, the Musikbund, that is funding pop music. This is amazing, right? They find contemporary voices in pop music and culture and fund them to create work, to commission new work, to create new collaborations, to go to residencies around the world to collaborate with other artists around, or the collaboration I did last year, basically, actually, it's this year, or already feels like last year, it was 3 months ago, where I got the chance to actually write a piece for the Deutsche Oper and present it in the Tischlerei, in the Deutsche Oper, you know, one of the most important opera houses in Germany. And suddenly there is a drag queen who tells a story, who writes the music, who is performing. And this is so important, right?
To kind of like
empower this in between. So I really hope that more of that is gonna be available. Because then you also see in the audience who came to this show, other queers, other drag queens, and also the audience of the Deutsche Oper, you know, right? The classical audience. We had the best singers in Berlin, the best musicians and acrobats. It was amazing. Everyone left this show thinking, oh my God, I feel so empowered right now. Doesn't matter if you are an old opera buff or a young opera fan, or if you're a drag queen. We found a way to make everyone feel empowered in this space. Isn't that magic?
Yeah. Do you yourself have like some kind of like guilty pleasure? I mean, I don't really like the word, but that's, I'm asking everybody this. It's like, do you have some kind of piece of culture, TV, music, whatever, where you think like nobody should know this? It's like, I love to listen to this, or I love to watch that, which you would never admit.
This would be so trashy, but I love trashy. What would it be? Okay, I mean, I already talked about drag, but Drag Race is not trashy. That's not
no.
Sure, that's high art.
Well, that's high art.
What?
I, for example, love shopping TV. That's my guilty pleasure. It's just like, if I turn on the TV, it's just like for the news or to watch QVC.
But do you actually buy?
Or
you
no.
just watch
no.
Doom scrolling?
No, I'm just enjoying the, like, just seeing what life has to offer. I don't buy. But now that you are asking, speaking of guilty pleasures, if I would buy, I would never admit.
Oh.
I would admit I'm watching it, but I would never tell in public if I would buy.
Oh my God.
If I would buy the creams and the puppets and the dolls and the...
Never. Oh my God.
I would never tell.
People not to tell it. Oh my God. That's got to be the best creamy.
Yeah.
Criminal theater piece.
Yeah. Like maybe there's some kind of music that you like to listen to, like Deutsche Schlager.
Oh my God, I love Deutsche. You know, oh my God, that's such an important topic. I love Deutsche Schlager. And I'm sorry, this is so elitist. I would never get it about Germany. Never. I love Helene Fischer. Sorry. Atemlos is one of the best songs written in Germany in the 20th century, or was it already the 21st? Whatever it is, it's an amazing song. Like, what it represents.
Sorry, Schubert. He has nothing.
So Schubert, yes.
Yeah, no.
Sorry.
The best lead is still Helene.
Helene, Atemlos, I can sing it in any language at any time of the day, and it will make me feel whole. It will make me feel sad. It will make me feel happy. It will make me feel like I have space in this world, really. And maybe it's because that when I moved to Berlin in 2012, that's around when this song came out, and all the drag queens were performing this song in the drag stages So as a drag queen, for me, that was my soundtrack of moving to Berlin. So for me, this song is really like representing the climax of
German culture.
Of German culture, yes.
Yes.
Really, Schlager is amazing. And you know what? When I sing, I love to sing this song. I also sing it in Hebrew. I have this translation we made with a friend. And when I sing it and German people suddenly hear it in Hebrew, they are mesmerized. They're like, what is this song? Some of them are smart and they know, oh, we hear the oh, oh, oh. So they immediately know. But all the rest are like, this is such a beautiful song. I'm like, that's yours. That's Atemlos. Stop hating it.